I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to The Connection. Have you ever had an aha moment when you suddenly get clarity on a problem that's been nagging you? You might be taking a walk or taking a shower, folding the laundry. How about the feeling of flow, of being in the zone, when you are totally absorbed with what you're doing and the rest of the world seems to just fall away? These joyful and creative experiences are what our guest, psychologist John Kunios, has been studying for years. He uses neuroimaging technology to understand what's happening in the brain when we are working to solve problems. He's discovered that creative insight, those eureka moments, and analytical thought, which is more deliberative, involve very different parts of the brain. While epiphanies don't happen every day, there are things you can do to create a more conducive environment for them to occur, involving things like mood and sleep. So today on The Connection, insight, creativity, and the brain. John Kunios is a professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Drexel University, where he is director of the Creativity Research Lab. He wrote a book about 10 years ago called The Eureka Factor, co-wrote it, I should say, Creative Insights and the Brain. John Kunios, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a real honor.
Well, let's start with creativity, because I think everyone has a different definition or even a different description of what creativity is or what creativity feels like. What is your working definition?
Well, in the field, there is no consensus, definitive definition that everyone agrees on. We have a working definition among creativity researchers, and that is it's the ability to come up with ideas or products that are both novel to the individual and also appropriate or useful. Hmm. So novel doesn't have to be novel to everyone. If I have an aha moment and I sit down and I write the play Hamlet, never having read Shakespeare's Hamlet before, right, it's still creative because it's novel to me. Useful because we want to exclude the sort of random ravings of a person who might be taking drugs or who might be schizophrenic. So we say often instead appropriate, because sometimes ideas may not seem useful at the time, but in 100 years, an idea that wasn't thought to be useful might be useful. So novel, appropriate, and sometimes we add surprising, because if it's obvious, then it's not creative. Everyone would be doing it.
I was thinking about creativity, obviously, in preparation for the show, which is called The Connection. And I think of creativity in terms of connections, the ability to attach one thing to something else.
Yes. You have to first break down what you have in front of you. So things are put together. You have ideas, associations, parts put together in one way. And then you have to break that down into its parts and then reassemble it into a new way that is new. So, at a fundamental level, you could think of musical scale.
Sure.
Those are the parts, and then we reassemble them into a new melody, a new tune, new harmony. But often we have to overcome fixation, a blockage, by looking at things in sort of their obvious way and then rearranging them to come up with something new.
You talk about having the sort of analytical brain and the insightful brain. The analytical brain, as you have found, involves the frontal lobe, and this is the sort of information, I guess, part of our brain. How does that work?
The frontal lobe is in charge of what we call executive processes, or sometimes cognitive control. So the frontal lobe of the brain, it controls the rest of the brain, organizes it, focuses it, inhibits parts of the brain. It gives a person sort of focus, direction, goals, plans, etc. And we can be creative in an analytical way by consciously and deliberately rearranging parts to come up with an idea. That said, if you reduce that frontal lobe activity one way or another, some people naturally have less frontal lobe activity, or if you're tired, or maybe you've had a drink or two or something like that, frontal lobe activity can diminish. And then we get sometimes called hypofrontality, less frontal lobe activity, less cognitive control. The other parts of the back parts of the brain go rogue and can be a little chaotic and generate all kinds of ideas that may be off the mark, but every once in a while there'll be some useful, brilliant, creative idea.
That's the aha moment.
Yes.
And you've been very specific that there's a kind of burst activity in the right temporal lobe. I mean, right sort of right above our right ear.
Well, in our first neuroimaging study of insights, the aha moment, we used a particular type of puzzle that involves giving people three words. We give them a whole bunch of these three-word puzzles. So, for example, pine, crab, sauce. And you have to think of a fourth word that makes a compound or familiar phrase with each of those.
Oh, dear.
And the answer
is apple.
My brain
is not working.
Pineapple, crab apple, applesauce. Now, those are hard. I mean, there are easier ones. There are harder ones. When you solve it by an aha moment, an area of the right temporal lobe, just above the right ear, lights up. And that's sort of a signature of insight, an aha moment, with those type of puzzles. With other kinds of puzzles that we've looked at, you can get that burst of activity, that high-frequency brain activity, in other parts of the brain. So there's no one aha part of the brain. It depends on the type of problem you're solving. What is common across these is that sudden burst of brain activity.
Well, you have talked about brain blinking, the sort of notion that there's this blink that happens in the brain when there's that burst of activity.
Yes, with these kinds of puzzles, a fraction of a second before you have the aha moment, your visual cortex, the part of the brain that processes incoming visual information, can reduce an activity. So it's sort of like you momentarily become less aware of your environment. And that cutting off of the senses that are distracting is what can allow this unconsciously activated idea to bubble up, to burst into awareness as an aha moment.
Is that why we sometimes will close our eyes if we're trying to think of something as a way of sort of cutting off the environment?
Yes. And in fact, closing your eyes is probably the simplest, easiest, cheapest way to have creative ideas. It can actually work. It's also why a part of the reason why we tend to have creative ideas, aha moments, in the shower. Because when you're in the shower, your vision's blurry. You don't hear anything but white noise. The shower's, unless it's a cold shower, the shower's warm, so you don't feel the boundary between your skin and the air. And you know you're not going to be bothered, right? Mm-hmm. And that you're not going to answer the phone while in the shower. So that cutoff of external stimulation allows the thoughts to sort of drift inward, your attention to point inward. And that enables these unconsciously activated ideas to bubble up to the surface.
Is that also because we're naked in the shower? Does that help with some of these creative moments?
Well, I don't think the experiment's done with enough people showering with clothes on to really know
to be
for
able
sure.
To,
so,
right.
You know, who knows, right?
Yeah.
we could do that experiment if we really want to. It might be a little complicated, but yes.
But there is that shower experience that really is a place to go where you could possibly find some insight.
Yes, and you can get that, you know, just sitting in a room quietly by yourself, closing your eyes, relaxing. It doesn't have to be in a shower, obviously, but that reduction in external stimulation can promote these aha moments.
And without going into great detail, but I think this is very important, you use EEG, so that mm-hmm. is measuring the activity in the brain, and fMRI, which is about blood flow. So literally looking at what is happening inside our heads as these experiences are going on.
Yes. EEG, which is the electrical activity of a person's brain, that's good at telling you when something's happening in the brain. And it's not as good at telling you where something's happening in the brain. fMRI is great at telling you where something's happening in the brain. It's less good at telling you when something's happening in the brain. So by using both of these techniques, we're able to pinpoint these aha moments in both space and time, the location in the brain and the moment of insight as well.
And why do you use these word problems, which I read were called compound remote associate puzzles, CRAP or CRAP?
Yes, that's what they're called.
Right. Okay,
yes,
just checking.
Yes. Well, traditionally, if you go back 100 years, aha moments, insight, were studied with these really difficult, complicated brain teasers that a person may not be able to solve at all, or it may take them hours or days to solve. And for doing neuroimaging, brain imaging, we need lots of examples of solutions. And so we needed to use little brief puzzles that a person could solve, if they solve them,
right,
and they solve maybe 50% of the time, they could solve them in a few seconds, up to 15 seconds or so. So we could give people lots and lots of these and test lots and lots. So we can't chase, we can't be, give people really complicated brain teasers and then chase them around and stuff them into a brain scanner when they're about to solve it. Just, it's just not practical.
Right.
So you could think of these little puzzles as sort of like, in a way, sort of like a mouse model in biomedical research. They're like the big puzzles, the big problems, but they're on a small scale, and we have no reason to believe that the brain activity is really that different from what you'd get if you were solving some life-changing problem.
So if we have one of these aha moments, does that mean the thing that we thought of is correct? Is that what makes it an aha moment?
Funny you should ask. That's a real, we have a paper on that. That's a really interesting question. So if you compare people's aha solutions to these puzzles, and we've tried this with many different types of puzzles, to their solutions when they solve the problem in a deliberate, conscious, analytical way, the aha solutions tend to be correct more often,
really,
than the analytical,
wow,
solutions.
Wow.
And that's kind of counterintuitive, because this idea pops into your head, why should you trust it, right? Well, the reason we think that's the case is that when you're thinking analytically, it takes effort, it takes focus, it takes concentration. Sometimes people are tired, they make a mistake. Sometimes they are impulsive or impatient, and it's like, all right, I got that idea, that's the solution, let's move on. The aha moments, those solutions, come from your unconscious mind.
Hmm.
Your unconscious mind doesn't care if you're tired. It doesn't care if you have a deadline. It's going to chug away at a problem, and when that solution is ready, when it's complete, it will pop into consciousness. So you can't cut it off too soon, because it's not there to cut off. So that's why these aha moments, we believe, tend to be correct more often than these analytical solutions. But we trust the analytical solutions more because we know how we got there. That's the problem, is, you know, we know how the sausage is made, where with aha moments, it's just presented in front of us and, you know, you take it on faith.
And we're up in a break here, but you've also said that we're more likely to remember our,
yes,
aha moments. Is it because it just feels right?
This is relatively recent research. People like Maxi Becker and Carol LaSalvi and other people have found the so-called insight memory effect. So when you have an idea from with an aha moment, you tend to remember it better later on,
wow,
than if you came up with the idea analytically. And we believe that's because aha moments activate the reward circuitry in the brain.
We
can talk about that.
We shall,
yes,
talk about that after this very short break. And again, John Kunios is our guest today on The Connection. He is a cognitive psychologist at Drexel University. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with John Kunios. He is a professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Drexel University and has spent years studying creativity and creative insight, which is what we are talking about today on the show. You talk about this reward part of why we remember our insightful aha moments maybe better than the ones that we find when it's driven by data. Why is that?
Well, the brain has one reward system. And it's the same reward system that's used to process pleasure from all sources, whether it's delicious foods, addictive drugs, orgasms, etc. And when having ideas, aha moments specifically,
right,
also activates the reward system of the brain for people who have an active reward system. So in one study we did, we used anagrams as puzzles. And we compared people, we measured their brain activity with EEG. We compared people who had very sensitive reward systems to those who had less sensitive reward systems. And we found that when these anagrams were solved with an aha moment, a tenth of a second after that burst of brain activity signaling the aha, there was a second burst of brain activity in the reward system of the brain.
Hmm.
So it's sort of this 1-2 punch. Aha, ah, is what it is.
Right.
And so there really is this pleasurable response when you have an aha moment. And in
it
some
feels
people,
good,
it
right?
feels, it's sort of mind expanding. It feels wonderful. And, you know, this is, we think this is why people like to do puzzles. They like to do crossword puzzles. They like to read murder mysteries. They like to write poetry or songs. They like to do scientific research. They crave those aha moments. And in fact, you even have this phenomenon of so-called starving artists who could get a high-paying job, but they don't want that. They need to have their creative expression, mm-hmm. and they'll take a low-paying job or a no-paying job, sculpting or painting or writing poetry, because they need that reward system activity.
You were talking about why the shower is so conducive to this, but I'm wondering about things like daydreaming, just letting your mind wander. Does that help bring on some of these insightful experiences?
Yes. So when the executive processes of the brain are at a low ebb, then insights are more likely to bubble up because you're less focused and less analytical. For example, time of day has an important role. If you're at your peak time of day, that's when you should do your analytical thinking. So if you're a night person, do your analytical thinking at night and do your creative thinking in the morning when you're a little bit fuzzy. Maybe your attention is not that controlled. Your mind is wandering a little bit. If you're a morning person, do your creative work at night when you're a little fuzzy. Also, one or two, not that I recommend people start drinking to be creative, but a drink or two of wine or beer has been shown to enhance a person's ability to have aha moments.
But not psychedelics. You've written about this, which is people taking psychedelics maybe often think they're having these aha moments or these creative, insightful breakthroughs, but reality says maybe not so much.
Well, with psychedelics, certainly people feel like they're having profound ideas. There's no question about that. The question is whether they're really having creative ideas.
Right.
And I think the research, I have not yet seen the rigorous research on that. So I think it is starting to come out, will be coming out soon, rigorous studies of that, but I haven't seen it yet. So the jury's still out on now, there is sort of a culture in Silicon Valley of tech people who want to have great ideas, and they supposedly microdose, like daily have a nice. low dose of psychedelics. And, my personal feeling is that if you want better ideas, hire a creative person. It's probably better right. for your brain than microdosing.
Or get a good night's sleep. Maybe.
Well, that also, yes. Sleep is supercharges creativity in several ways. One is it improves your mood, and a positive mood enhances creative insight. But it also reorganizes the information in your brain during certain phases of sleep to bring out details and hidden associations. And it also allows you to let go of or forget wrong or bad ideas that you're fixated on. That's called fixation forgetting. So sleep is like one of the most powerful. And there are many stories of scientists and artists who have some of their best ideas. They're either awakened by them in the middle of the night or when they wake up in the morning before they're fully awake.
Well, Paul McCartney and Yesterday,
yes,
right?
Yes, the song Yesterday. That's a great example right there. René Descartes, the philosopher and mathematician, he used to lie in bed in the morning, and he had the luxury of sleeping in late. And before he was fully awake, he would have ideas in bed, and he came up with the analytic geometry, lying there watching a fly buzzing around the room, the bedroom. So there are even examples of Nobel Prize-winning ideas that people had were awakened in the middle of the night by such ideas.
And sleep, of course, has a big effect on our mood, whether
yes.
we feel anxious or whether we feel rested and secure and happy. So how does that figure into our thinking and into insight?
Well, anything that improves your mood is going to enhance aha moments. So sleep is one of those things. Everyone's grumpy when they don't get enough sleep. Right. I know I am. So getting enough sleep elevates mood. That is one of the ways that presumably that it helps people to be more creative.
Is there a connection between analytical thinking and anxiety? Is there that if you're more anxious, you might kind of fall back on analytical thinking?
Yes. So I'll give you sort of a hypothetical story. This is courtesy of my co-author and collaborator, Mark Beeman, who's at Northwestern University. Imagine you're an early human on the savannah in Africa, and you see a lion way off in the distance. So immediately you're anxious. You focus on the lion. You think to yourself very deliberately, can that lion see me? Can that lion hear me? Am I upwind or downwind? Can the lion smell me? If I make a break for it, can the lion catch me? Etc. So you think in a very deliberate analytical way because you cannot afford to make a mistake.
Right.
You make a mistake, you're lunch. Right? Now, that's analytical thinking. Now, let's say you
and
get
it's
away.
It's filled with data, right?
It's data. It's very focused. It's very risk averse. And then let's say you get away. And that night, you're in with your clan in the cave. There's an antelope roasting on the spit, and you're with your loved ones, you're safe, you're warm, you have food. Under those circumstances, the sense of threat is low. We have what's called psychological safety. In those cases, there's no risk saying something crazy, wild, funny, or creative. And some of those things are going to be great ideas. But the lack of risk allows one to expand the scope of thought to include ideas that a person would not think of if they were under stress or threat.
So we use both. I mean, depending on
the
circumstance, if there's a lion there, we're going to keep our eye on the lion and make sure that we have a safe distance between them and us.
Yes.
And if we're feeling relaxed and creative and among friends, something else is going to be operational.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Now, we don't have complete control over that,
right?
Because in modern society, we have this sort of low level sense of threat all the time, deadlines, traffic, you know, all kinds of things that are not really life threatening, but still they put pressure on us, and that low level sense of threat can make us very analytical and degrade creative thought. And then the other people who, you know, maybe have trouble focusing even under a sense of threat, and they might be very creative. They might have ADHD, for example, and which many people who have ADHD, anecdotal evidence seems to suggest they have creative gifts as well. And we're just starting to do research on that.
Well, it's interesting to think of we're learning more about the neurodivergent either brain or mind or thinking and how it might operate differently, but still is very much operating in the world.
Yes. Now, we don't know much about that. Not much research has been done on the relationship between different forms of neurodiversity and creativity. The vast majority of the research has been done in so-called neurotypical people.
Right.
So there really isn't a lot to say about that at this point.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's John Cunios. He's a professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Drexel University. He's director of the Creativity Research Lab at Drexel, co-authored a book a number of years ago called The Eureka Factor, and we are talking about creative insight and how our brain works and how to figure out how we navigate through the world. I was wondering, too, whether there's a connection between humor, maybe even improv, and this insightful part of our brain.
Well, humor involves a positive mood.
True.
So if you're in a positive mood, you'll be better at improvisation. And so actually the relationship between mood and creativity is bidirectional, goes both ways. If you're in a positive mood, you're more likely to be creative. But the act of being creative, as particularly with aha moments, because it activates the reward system of the brain, it puts you in a good mood.
Right.
So it can sort of get this feedback loop. Feel good, creative. That makes you feel better, then you become more creative. So improvisation, if it's done in a involving aha moments, insights along
which
the
it
way,
often is. I mean, it's sort of
yes.
not thinking, thinking, yes. not thinking at
now,
the same time.
Now, that said, some people who are improv comedians or musicians improvise through years and years of experience, those circuits of the brain that allow them to do that, they get baked in and unconscious, And then you get a state of flow, which arises, creative flow arises from years of experience and then letting go, having the confidence to release cognitive control and let one's expertise take over.
And I think for those people that have had that experience, which I've rarely had, but I have had, it is one of the more pleasurable feelings in life, that feeling of flow.
Yes, absolutely. People crave that. Once they experience that sense right. of flow, they crave it because it activates the reward system of the brain. And it can, and instead, in contrast with an aha moment, which is sort of this burst of activity and then it recedes, flow, say you're a jazz musician, which yeah. we've studied the brains of jazz musicians, that's extended in time. And they lose a sense of time, they lose a sense of self, and their expertise sort of takes over, and it's like someone else playing through them, and they're just sitting back enjoying it.
What about the role of rewards or awards or prizes, things like that? How does that affect creativity or even the ability to have insightful moments?
So creativity can be the result either of persistence right. on a problem, in which case you're doing analytical thinking. You just stick with it. You stick with it. You keep reasoning through it, or through breadth of thinking, opening yourself up to new ideas. Rewards, like I'll pay you to have a great to solve this problem, that will keep you working on the problem, keep a lot of people working on the problem. It doesn't necessarily mean the idea you come up with will be more creative. And in fact, there's plenty of evidence that rewards inhibit creative insights.
Really?
In contrast, the intrinsic reward of having an aha moment is what motivates people to have aha moments, right? So
you don't need that $100
or whatever. In fact, there was a famous study done by Sam Glucksberg, a cognitive psychologist, back in the early 1960s, where he showed that when you give people a problem to solve, if it does not involve a creative twist, then rewarding them for solving it enhances their ability to solve it. But if the problem does involve a creative twist, paying them for the solutions, rewarding them, inhibits their ability to solve
wow.
the problem. They
wow.
solve fewer problems.
You know, I was wondering too about, since we're talking both about creativity and the brain, as people get older, you do get experience. And so they're, you know, things are maybe not quite as novel. Hopefully you have some level of expertise. But I wonder whether this sort of insight versus analyst, whether that changes at all as we age.
You know, there isn't a lot of good research on that yet. So it's hard to say. As a person gets older, their executive processes may start to degrade once right. they get into old age, particularly if there's some early dementia, mild cognitive impairment. That doesn't necessarily mean that the rest of the brain is degrading at the yeah. same rate. So a person who might be a very skilled jazz musician, for example, in theory, that should affect their improvisation less as they get older than it would if they were doing something that involved real analytical thought.
Right.
So, but again, not a lot of research has been done on that aspect of it, and that's something that is needed.
Well, I was also thinking of babies, of young children. Obviously, their brain is still developing. It's very flexible and fluid, and yet they are discovering things all the time. I mean, that's the job of childhood, is to figure out the world.
Yes.
Do we know how their brains are working?
Well, we know a little bit about this aspect of it. So when you have an aha moment, you're an adult. You're breaking out of the box. You're thinking outside of the box. A young child doesn't have the box.
That's true.
They don't know enough. So the young children say and do things that to adults look creative, but they're really just kind of random sometimes, right? And it's like we, as adults, we couldn't think of that.
Brilliant.
But it's
right?
just sort of like random stuff for the kid. So creativity in a child may not be the same thing as it is right. for an adult.
I was thinking, too, of therapy, and it's probably hard to do research on talk therapy. But, people that have been in therapy talk about having moments of insight where something they have been working on for years, talking with someone, a professional largely, you begin to get some kind of insight on what is going on or the patterns of your behavior. How do you see that as a brain scientist, a cognitive scientist?
There's a little bit of research on this. And the research, some research involved structured interviews of people who had undergone talk therapy. And what they seem to, many times they report having an aha moment that sort of clarified everything. But what they also report is interesting is sort of, they have the aha moment and they realize they kind of knew that all along, but it at some unconscious level, and then it pops into awareness, and then they sort of look back, yeah, I could see that was happening all along. So it may be that the idea, that the therapeutic idea evolves over time, and then at a certain point, it pops into awareness.
Yeah.
Now, here's an interesting point about this, too, is that Freudian psychoanalysis involving you lie back on a couch, you stare at a ceiling, you just free associate.
And not too many people do that.
Not anymore. It was very popular, particularly in the 40s and 50s, right. Among the Hollywood set, for example. But a lot of people report that they feel better. One possibility is that people who do that, they have aha moments. Whether the aha moments are true or false, that aha moment about their lives can stimulate the reward system of the brain and make them feel better. So even if they have a false insight about themselves, that doesn't mean it's not making them feel better.
And the feeling better is it's not just the reward, but it maybe says you're onto something.
Well, that's part of the reward. That idea that you're onto something, even if you're on the wrong track,
right.
That makes you feel better. And in principle, may relieve some of the symptoms.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's psychologist John Cunios, and he has spent many, many years looking at creativity, creative insight, which is what we have been talking about. And we have waiting in the wings Jennifer Higdon. She is a composer, and we will continue. We're all waving at her now. We will continue our conversation, getting her part of the conversation, helping us understand the creative process. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Today on The Connection, we're talking about insight, creativity, and the brain. And again, John Cunios is our guest, professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Drexel University, also director of the Creativity Research Lab at Drexel, wrote a book about 10 years ago called The Eureka Factor. And joining us now is Jennifer Higdon, one of the most performed and prolific classical music composers working today. I honestly do not have time or can do justice to her bio because it's really, really, really long. Suffice it to say, she has received numerous awards for her work, including a Pulitzer Prize and several Grammys. She taught herself to play the flute when she was a teenager and for years was a professor of composition at the Curtis Institute of Music here in Philadelphia. She lives now in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where she works as a composer. And we wanted her to be part of this conversation about creativity and insight because she composes every day and her output is impressive. Jennifer Higdon, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Oh, it's good to be here.
And this is John Cunios. So we have been talking about creativity, and we're happy to have you here. I'm wondering, as someone who has really spent so many years as a composer, does it get harder? Does it get easier? Is each piece that you're working on like starting afresh, or do you feel like you have a base of knowledge and experience that you can build on?
That's a really good question. I do feel like I have a base of knowledge and experience, but the first several weeks of working on a new piece always brings massive anxiety. Like, will I be able to remember how to write? Even though I write every day, it's kind of a fascinating thing. And part of my job is talking myself off the ledge to trust my instincts that have been developing over time, but also to trust my brain to come up with solutions when I feel backed into a corner and I can't figure out how to make something work. And it's been interesting through the years, having started out music as a self-taught person going into college, I've kind of been very keen on watching my own brain develop as this has gone along over time. It has gotten easier for me to write, but it still has the same associated anxieties. I'm just able to calm myself down a little bit better now. But you might find this interesting. I used to have, prior to writing my first opera, I used to have problems following words in pop songs and operas. And after I wrote an opera and spent basically 2 years singing through the texts and writing music for it, my brain felt like it rewired. And now I can't shut that aspect of my brain off. So every pop song, every movie, even, I hear all the words and I'm like, oh, I didn't realize they said that. And it was an interesting thing to discover, having gone through the process of writing an opera for the first time. It really did rewire my brain. It started processing differently.
Well, that's fascinating. I'm going to give John a chance to weigh in, but I have a quick follow-up to you, Jennifer. As you said, you get anxious. You feel like you're sort of at war with yourself. So what do you do? Where do you go to, I guess, calm down and maybe even to find that feeling of creativity?
Yeah, I think the trick is to push through, strangely enough, to give yourself permission to get rid of anything that you've, it's like throwing, spaghetti noodles at the wall, trying to figure out what might work. So you push through, keep creating ideas, and give yourself permission to fail, which is a big thing. Give yourself permission to throw it away or to say, not a good idea. And sometimes when you're doing that and you're trying a bunch of ideas, something that may not feel good in one particular day may appear the next day to be something that's actually a lively little idea that might germinate more ideas. So there's a certain suspension of judgment, basically.
Now, you do not know Jennifer's brain, per se, but you have studied jazz musicians here in Philadelphia, done some research with them, and obviously with improv and the brain. What did you find?
So the David Rosen, who at the time was a graduate student in my laboratory, took the lead in the study, where we measured the EEGs of a number of jazz musicians. Some of them were pianists, some of them were guitarists in different studies. And we looked at the quality or the creativity of their performances as rated by external judges, as a function of their level of experience or expertise. How many years, how many gigs have they played over years? And some of them were relative novices, others had been playing for 30, 40 years. And one thing we found that is maybe not surprising is that the ones who were more experienced, their performances were on average more creative than the less experienced musicians. But we also found, we asked them about their sense of flow, this feeling of release and effortless attention and effortless performance. And you find that much more often in the most experienced musicians compared to the less experienced musicians. And you could see this change in the brain activity. So in the less experienced musicians, we have activity in the frontal lobes and in the right hemisphere. And then as they become more experienced over decades, that shifts to the back of the brain on the left side.
Wow.
And it becomes baked in. We sort of isolated the brain activity associated with the flow experience in jazz improvisation.
Can you just, I assume, Jennifer, you've had flow experiences where it just feels like you're totally in the moment and things are coming to you?
Yes. And it's kind of incredible because they didn't used to have those when I was starting out, because you question absolutely everything you do. And I found when I was actually playing an instrument that I had extra steps in my thinking where I had to think about my breathing, the embouchure, how I control my fingers, do they align with what I'm wanting to articulate? And I have found, talking to a lot of musicians now, that it's amazing when you play an instrument, because you become so fluent on handling the mechanics that part of your brain can release, and you spend that energy in a more creative sort of spin. But that's tricky with composition, because we don't have the same sort of solid evidence when we're creating, but I think we develop more trust, which is probably a similar sort of thing. And it would be really interesting to find out a composer which parts of the brain were firing. And because it is, I can remember there have been instances where I thought something was going to take me 2 or 3 weeks to write. And I can remember this with a particular opera duet. And what I ended up writing came out in 6 hours. And it was fairly shocking. I had to step back. And John actually referred to this as, you know, when you're a child, you're not judging or anything. You have to sometimes be able to pull yourself back to be that child, to allow unexpected things to carry you to magic places, basically. That's the the place you want to be. And the thing is to trust that it's okay, which is pretty hard because as adults, we try to control everything.
Well, and I wonder too, whether that day that was so productive, did you do something different? Did you have a good night's sleep? Did you have a delicious breakfast? Is it your favorite pen you had? I mean, was there something, some of those sort of magical thinking that goes into that sometimes?
Those are those things, you know, when I started the day, I hadn't done anything different. And I remember I sat down and I thought, 2 weeks, this is going to take 2 weeks. But suddenly it started pouring out. And even now when I hear that music, I'm still a little shocked by it. But what's also striking is I get a chance to get feedback from audience members who don't know the story behind the writing, but they also have a more intense response to that one duet I can't think of an explanation, but they're sensing it.
Does that make sense to you, John?
Absolutely, it makes sense. Now, with more and more experience, you probably get into that float state more often. As you mentioned earlier in your career, you had to think, you know, in a very deliberate way about what you were doing. And that grows with experience. But if I could ask a question. So I watched an interview you did at the Library of Congress. And when you talked about your creative process, you went into a lot of detail about the strategic analytical things, about what instruments there would be, how many instruments, what the hall would be like, who the musicians were, what what kind of piece it was supposed to be. And then you talked about having ideas and then assembling them into a composition, but you didn't talk about where the ideas come from. You didn't talk about, right, or at least mystery. your experience of how the ideas come to you. And it's okay if you don't know. I mean, that's all right. As long, you've got the ideas. That's the important part. But if you have something to tell us about that, I'd really like to know.
Sure.
Yeah, it is fascinating because I always start my process for every piece knowing certain things, examining the performer I'm writing for, what kind of music do they like, what do they want in their piece, what they do not want. And you do have to think about, they always tell you what the duration is going to be, and you know the instrumentation. But part of this, I always attribute it to magic. You can't see what the brain is coming up with. There have been days where I felt like I was hitting my head against the wall. I couldn't come up with an idea. And on the third day, I woke up and it was there. And you're like, where did that come from? So, but the flow, I can get into the flow so much easier. It used to be just such a struggle. And now it can happen at any point in time, even when I'm sitting in a restaurant. So it's like my brain is constantly chewing on the issues of whatever it is I'm trying to create.
Do you have, I mean, sometimes like just a theme that's just like a loop in your head that you just
Yes.
you have to get down eventually, but it's there?
Yes, absolutely. And I always try to write something down on a scrap of paper or a napkin or something to remind myself so that my brain doesn't move on and forget it, because I have lost things before because I didn't get them down.
Well, we asked you to send us a little piece of music, which I have here, and this is it's called Concerto 4-3.
4-3.
Yes, okay.
It. Yeah.
And it's movement one. It's less than a minute, but I just wanted to give our listeners and John, our guest here, just a chance to hear this, and we can talk about your thinking that went into it. Let's give it a listen. And that was written for Time for Three, and that's also the Philadelphia Orchestra there. And Jennifer, I really love that piece of music, I have to say. Just a taste there, but help us understand the thinking, the creativity that went into that.
Yeah, this was an interesting prompt. It was commissioned from the Philadelphia Orchestra, and they made a very unusual request. They wanted a bluegrass classical hybrid concerto for this particular group. It's not a normal bluegrass group, two violins and a bass. But I knew the soloists because they'd been at Curtis. So I kind of knew their personalities, their penchant for improvising. But they also love to make really odd sounds on their instruments. So I had to really think about what is bluegrass and how can I mix that with classical while also showing off what these guys do on their own. So we actually went into a practice room and I recorded them doing really unusual techniques. What that opening there has a bunch of them, and I had to invent a new kind of notation to be able to get that back on the page so they could come back and do it when I finished writing it 8 months later. And that way they would have kind of a map that they could go off of. But it took really kind of thinking outside the box. I couldn't think theoretically. I had to think about the energy that bluegrass brings. How do you meld that in a classical context so it can be assembled quickly in rehearsal?
Do you think, and I mean, every composer has their unique approach to music, but do you think, Jennifer, the fact that you didn't come to classical music until, you know, I guess well into your teenage, maybe even young adult years, you didn't grow up listening to Beethoven and Bach.
Right.
You taught yourself the flute, correct?
Yeah.
Do you think that, you know, just having the, I would say probably unusual within the classical world, that's sort of a spark for your creativity?
Absolutely, because it taught me to think differently, also to question absolutely everything. But one of the things I've noticed, the difference between a lot of my music and some of my colleagues is because I grew up around rock and roll and bluegrass and country, my brain wants to turn ideas over faster. So in my creative process, I'm constantly changing the color that's going on in the ensemble. I'm also changing the theme. I love to be able to tap my foot. And I'm pretty sure that my brain is wired along the things that I heard, as any composer does when they're growing up. I didn't know I was a composer. I was interested in creative endeavors, but it's fascinating, actually fascinating to think, yeah, I think there are really deep connections from starting late.
Well, you know, John, we're almost out of time here, and we had you on because we wanted to talk about creativity, and hearing the two of you talk, especially you, Jennifer, is just, it makes me just so happy to be a human being that we do this stuff, and we spend all this time and energy and imagination to create something.
Yes, and the thing that's a challenge to that now is the ascendance of AI. So, which AI can create things. It can create essays and poetry and music, and sometimes it's not bad. It's not at the level of what Jennifer Higdon can do and other wonderful composers, but it's not going to get worse. It's going to get better. And what we are at risk of losing is how the creativity that we express shapes us, how it affects our brains, how it results in our own human development if we outsource too much of it, especially when we're younger. And we don't have that opportunity to bake in these creative processes. You know, I would say people shouldn't use AI chatbots until they're at least 30. That's my opinion. After that, okay,
yeah,
fine.
Yeah, whatever.
You know,
whatever.
Right, yeah.
Well, we don't have time to delve into that, Jennifer, and I'm sure you have opinions on it, but I'm just wondering, once you've written something and it's being played by, let's say, an orchestra, that experience for you, because you've handed it over to other people to perform.
It's actually kind of scary. And part of it is I'm pulling for the players, and part of it's hoping that I made the right guesses for simple things like the balance of a tuba and a flute. And some of that's knowledge that I'm not so sure AI is going to be able to pick up, because the understanding, you almost have to be in the room repeatedly going through that experience to really kind of learn it. But it does strike me, the AI thing is a very serious consideration, but that duet in Cold Mountain, there's 2.5 hours, but that one duet stands out. So is it the soul? Is it a sense of something particular related that resonates in all of us? So it's going to be interesting to see how this develops.
Yeah, and Cold Mountain is the opera that you wrote based on the novel that was written a number of years ago. Well,
right.
Jennifer Higdon, thank you so much for joining us even briefly today on The Connection.
My pleasure.
And she is an award-winning composer. And John Cunios, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
Talking about creativity, he's a professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Drexel University, where he is director of the Creativity Research Lab, wrote a book, or co-authored a book a number of years ago called The Eureka Factor. Well, go to whyy.org/theconnection to find out much more about the program. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow The Connection on Instagram, and you can find us on Facebook. Al Bang's the engineer for today's edition of The Connection, the show produced by Debbie Builder with Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.